So we are in Leviticus. We're going to be picking up in about chapter 8. This is just a quick reminder. Leviticus fits into that gap of time period between whence the tabernacle was built and before they head out to potentially go and conquer the land. There's going to be a whole generation that doesn't get to do that, but that's the plan, at least, to go and head towards the land. And the time period between there is a very specific amount of time. And so it's 1 month, 20 days, so roughly 50 days total that all of these events take place. So as we look at Leviticus, we spent the first seven chapters looking at the sacrificial laws. As we go tonight, my goal is to hit about chapter 22. We'll see whether that actually happens or not. But looking to do Leviticus in about four classes, because there's a lot of things that we can cover fairly quickly without really getting bogged down in the details of, and for example, what we're about to head into the chapters 8 through 10, where you talk about the consecration of the priests and putting them in place. So we'll be looking at these two chunks tonight, the priesthood, and then laws regarding uncleanness, and those are going to be a fairly broad spectrum of things. So we kind of hop around at quite a lot of different topics when we talk about things that are unclean. In chapters 8 and 9, it begins with, in chapter 8, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, "Take Aaron and his sons with him, and the garments and the anointing oil, and the bull of the sin offering, and the two rams, and the basket of the unleavened bread, and assemble all the congregation at the door of the tent of meeting." So Moses did just as the Lord commanded him. And when the congregation was assembled at the door of the tent of meeting, Moses said to the congregation, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded to do." And so from there, we get this big description of all of these different things that are done to consecrate. You'll see down in verse 10, Moses took the anointing oil and anointed the tabernacle and all was in it and consecrated them. So we're going to consecrate the temple. We're going to consecrate the priests and all of their garments. And so everything is consecrated through a variety of things. Some are consecrated through washing, where they'd be washed in water. Some of the things are consecrated through blood, where there would be a sprinkling of blood. Some are consecrated through anointing oil. And some are consecrated through a combination of those things. So really, for our purposes, in chapter 8 and 9, what we need to know is what on earth is happening here. What does it mean to consecrate the priests, as well as the temple itself? So the word consecrate is, it means to set something in place. It's the word that you would use if you were going to set like a stone. So you're going to consecrate that stone in the piece of jewelry. You're going to fasten it into the position that it ought to be. It means also it's used to make something sacred, to make it holy. So you're taking it from a position where it's just a common thing and you're making it a holy or sacred thing. So in the case here of the all of the things regarding the temple, in particular at this point we're talking about the priestly garments and whatnot, you start out with the priest's garments are, they're fancy in that they're made exactly according to the pattern, but at this point they're just clothes. I mean, anybody could theoretically make these exact same garments. But now when we consecrate them, they move from just being fancy clothes to being, these are for the priests and the priests alone. This is making them sacred. They're part of that particular job. The third aspect of consecration is it's used to renew or to make something full, make it complete, make it as it ought to be. So you think about when you have a piece of jewelry and you've got the prongs sitting up there, and then you put the stone in and you lock the prongs on it. Now you can say, ah, the jewelry is as it ought to be. It's fully complete. And so that's the idea of consecration. So what is happening is that Moses is taking the priesthood and saying, okay, now you're no longer normal men. Now your life is no longer just about you. You're not just like every other member of the Jewish society. Now you are a special group of people, And you have some special privileges because of that. Most importantly, you have the privilege to go into the temple, go into the holy place. If you're the high priest, you have the right to go into the holy of holies, the most holy place. You have the right and privileges to eat certain portions of the sacrifices that will be made, all of these different things. But you also have certain responsibilities that you have to fulfill. You're no longer a normal person. And so this consecration is a big event, because after this, Moses is the one who consecrates the priest. But after he consecrates the priest, Moses is no longer going to be involved in the process of any of the sacrifices or any of the temple work. And we think of Moses as a pretty big deal. And yet it's being passed off. Nope. That's for the priest now. Now that they've been consecrated, now that they're set in order, that's their job and nobody else's. And so chapters 8 and 9 lay all of that out. And then the verse I have down there in Leviticus 9 down to verse 6 is right where, after all of this is done, as they're finishing up the consecration, Moses says, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded you to do, that the glory of the Lord may appear to you." So that's, if you really want to boil down, what's the big deal about the priests? They are being set apart as a sacred group of people so that they and they alone can have the glory of the Lord appear to them. Now, in particular, that's referencing the high priest, because the high priest once a year is going to go into the Holy of Holies, and who's going to appear to him there? It's going to be God, right? The glory of the Lord is going to appear and forgive the people of their sins right there before the mercy seat. So all of this is laid out about how special the priests are in chapters 8 and 9. And all of all of this is done, as you look at the first verses there in chapter 8, all of this is done in front of the whole assembly of the people. So this is a giant ceremony that everybody is watching about how things are being put into place, and these men are special men. Which then brings you, after all of those events, into chapter 10, where we see them break that consecration or not value it enough. Anybody have any questions on chapters 8 and 9? Okay, so that moves us to chapter 10. So after all has been said about how special they are, and they alone can do these certain things, and they alone are consecrated for the worship and the sacrifices before God, the next thing that we see happen is this story with Nadab and Abihu. Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. And Moses said to Aaron, "It is what the Lord spoke, saying, 'By those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored.' So Aaron, therefore, kept silent." So this event with Nadab and Abihu is a pretty big one, because it's a learning moment. It's somewhat similar when you think in the New Testament about Ananias and Sapphira. Ananias and Sapphira are the first people to ever have any sort of punishment under the new covenant. Up until this point, everything's been great in the book of Acts, and everything's going well. And then you have this couple, they come in and they lie. And they lie about what seems like not a very big deal. They gave a bunch of money and they kept back part of it. It's like, well, they weren't being quite as generous as they wanted everybody to think they were. And God's reaction to it is what? What has he do to Ananias and Sapphira? Yeah, kills them, strikes them both dead. This is very similar. Nadab and Abihu are the Aaron's sons, so they're not the high priest, but they're one of them would have been next in line for the high priest. And they come in, and they are worshiping God, but they're not doing it the way he commanded. And Leviticus 10 is a great set of verses to go to explain this idea of the silence of the scriptures. There are so many things that are in the religious world as a whole where people do things and they say, well, God never said we can't. And the whole argument for rock bands and instrumental music is based off of that. God didn't say we can't use a rock band. God didn't say we can't do this or that. And so if you take an attitude with the Bible that says, I can do it unless God specifically says no. How many things are open to you? Pretty much everything, right? I mean, the amount of things that you can do at that point are huge. And it's kind of like, taking your kid to the doctor's office, and you don't lay down a list of everything that they can't do. Don't climb the walls. Don't paint on the walls. Don't attack people. Don't play with the medical equipment. You don't lay out all those things. Most of the time, you take your kids to the doctor's office and you say, sit there and be quiet. And anything they do other than sit there and be quiet is wrong. Well, that's the way God works with us. If he had to make a list of everything you can't do, the Bible would be too big to fit in this building. But instead he says, this is what to do. And in the case here, he had told them what incense to burn and where to get the fire from. The fire was supposed to come from the altar. Now, where do these guys get the fire from? You have no idea. It doesn't tell you. All it says is it was strange fire, meaning it came from some place other than which God had commanded. So they did something that God never specifically said, you can't do that. They just did something that he hadn't said no to. And they thought it was no big deal. But God strikes them dead. And Moses' answer to Aaron, and you think about Aaron, this is very personal for him. This is his children. You can't get a more personal circumstance than seeing something awful happen to your child. And Moses says to Aaron, the thing that they did wrong is those who come near me, I'll be treated as what? I'll be treated as holy. And if you don't treat God as holy, this is what happens. And he says, if you don't treat me as holy, I'm also not being honored before all the people. And so Aaron kept silent. In other words, Aaron, who would have been, of all people, somebody to say, wait a second, what kind of justice is this? Or what kind of a God would do this? Or that's too harsh, or that's too mean. Moses gives him the answer, and Aaron says nothing. Aaron is shut up by that argument that even if it is your own child, this is the way it is. And so here is laid out in chapter 8 and 9, he says, we see how special the job is. And in chapter 10, we get the practical application of that, which is of all the people in the nation of Israel who had to be the most careful about the way that they behaved, it's going to be the priests. Because they're the ones coming near me. And he says, those who come near me, I will be treated as holy. Now make a New Testament application. Who's the priesthood in the New Testament? We are. That's right. We're the priesthood. So of all the people on the planet, who has to be the most careful about treating God as holy in every aspect of our life? It's going to be us. And you can think about the connection there. How many times have people said bad things about God, or they have maligned the name of Christ because they saw a Christian doing something that they do all the time, but since we call ourselves Christians, even the world holds us to a higher standard. All right, so we as Christians have to treat God as holy at all times because we come near to him and before all the people he should be honored. Aaron remains silent, and then there in verse 4 it says, Moses also called them Mishael and Elzaphan, the sons of Aaron's uncle Uziel, and said to them, come forward, carry your relatives away from the front of the sanctuary to the outside of the camp. So they came forward and carried them still in their tunics to the outside of the camp, as Moses had said. And Moses said to Aaron and to his sons Eleazar and Ithamar, do not uncover your heads, nor tear your clothes, so that you will not die, and that he will not become wrathful against all the congregation. But your kinsmen, the whole house of Israel, shall bewail the burning which the Lord has brought about. You shall not even go out from the doorway of the tent of meeting, or you will die, for the Lord's anointing oil is upon you. So they did according to the word of Moses. So, how far did this extend to this idea that they had to treat God holy and and accept God's judgment on Nadab and Abihu. Aaron and his family weren't even allowed to mourn. They had to stay in the tent of meeting, stay in that area, and not mourn. The rest of the nation could, but they had to treat God as holy and represent Him in that. And then it goes on from there in verse 8. It says, "The Lord then spoke to Aaron, saying, 'Do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you when you come into the tent of meeting, so that you will not die. It's a perpetual statute throughout your generations, and so to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, and between the unclean and the clean. And so as to teach the sons of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them through Moses.'" This next event where after all the mourning, also they're commanded, don't drink strong drink when you come into the tent of meeting. It never flat out says it, but there's an implication there that what might have been one of the reasons that Nadab and Abihu ended up burning strange fire. Might have been drunk. They might have had impaired thinking because they had drank some alcohol. It doesn't say that for sure, but the implication seems to be all of these things happen, and then the very next thing they're warned about is, don't you be drinking. And so, if that's the case, would also add to, do you get a free pass when you do something when your judgment was impaired from alcohol? Nope. And that's of course, the problem a lot of times with drinking, is that you don't know what you'll do when you're not sober. Do you really want to risk doing something unforgivable in a moment when you weren't in your full capacity and faculties? Just one more reason to think about alcohol and the amount of problems that it presents for people. So from there, Moses then is going to speak to, in verse 12, to Aaron and to his surviving sons, Eleazar and Ithamar. So now Nadab and Abihu are now gone, and he has two other sons, Eleazar and Ithamar. And so from now on, when you hear about Aaron's family, it'll be of the lineage of Eleazar or the lineage of Ithamar, because those are the two surviving sons. Anybody have any comments or questions? Okay. If I am teaching people about silence of the scriptures, I might just emphasize again, this is one of Leviticus 10:1 is one of the first verses I'll go to teach the principle of, if the Bible hasn't commanded it, then we don't do it. We're going to speak where the Bible speaks and be silent where it's silent. Okay, so from there, we're going to move in to, starting in chapter 11, you have all of these laws of uncleanness. We're not going to go verse by verse through all of them, but we'll look at some of the highlights of it and consider. But Leviticus 20, down in verse 24 through 26, says, "I'm the Lord your God who has separated you from the peoples. You are therefore to make a distinction between the clean animal and the unclean, and between the unclean bird and the clean. Thus you are to be holy to me." So just like the priests were to be holy, and they had some very specific rules for the priests because they came near to God in the work of the temple worship. The whole nation was supposed to be holy to God. And the way that they were to do that was to make these distinctions between clean and unclean. Now, an unclean thing simply means something that will cause defilement or is capable of defiling. So it's exactly what we think of when we think of germs. If you have something that isn't clean, and then it touches something that's clean, does the clean thing make the unclean thing clean, or is it the other way? Okay, unclean things make clean things dirty. If you've got dirty hands and you start touching a clean tablecloth, the tablecloth won't clean your hands, but you will definitely make the tablecloth dirty. Unclean things are things that defile you. Now, in the Old Testament is a physical representation. And when you get to the book of Hebrews in particular, it lays this out over and over and over again, that the Old Testament it gave a physical representation so you could understand some greater spiritual ideas. Unclean things in the Old Testament are not the same as sin. There's going to be some things in there that they'll talk about unclean. You say, well, is he saying it's a sin? No, he's not saying it's a sin. But it's a physical type that illustrates sin's effects. And an unclean under the Old Testament could defile you and prevent you from worship and service to God. Meaning if you were unclean, you were unable to go and make sacrifices. You were unable to partake of different feasts and festivals, such as the Passover. It kept you from doing things that you would normally do in the process of serving God. It separated you from Him. Now, in the Old Testament, some of these things were very physical things. We'll talk about leprosy. And where we can get confused is we say, oh, so is God saying that all lepers are not able to be saved? No, that's not at all the point. The point is this is a physical representation of a spiritual concept. So just like the Jews of the Old Testament had physical things that would separate them from going to the temple or partaking of worship there, there are things that can separate us from God, and they're not physical things. The things that separate us from God in the New Testament we know are what? Sin. So if you want to understand how sin is to God, look up pictures of leprosy. If you want to look up pictures of leprosy and see what that does to the human body, and the way that we react to that kind of physical uncleanness, that's the way God reacts to spiritual uncleanness. And so it's a physical representation to teach a bigger idea behind it. So what we have to remember is the unclean things of the Old Testament are not always the same as sin. Now, there are some things that are sin. And the easy way to find out is there are things that, one, God will... if God calls it an abomination, I can guarantee you it's a sin. All the things that are counted as abominations in the Old Testament show up in the New Testament as very clearly sins. The other is to just simply say, well, in the New Testament, is it considered a sin? Well, if it is in the New Testament, guess what it was in the Old Testament? And so you're going to see that connection there as well. And so there are some things that are sin things, but most of the things that you see with uncleanness really don't have a lot to do with sin. They have to do with this physical representation to teach this idea of this in the same way that when somebody has touched a dead body and has been involved in working in a morgue, we want them to clean themselves up before they come to dinner or our house. That's how God feels about sin, is that what it's done to your soul has made it unclean and unpalatable to be around. And so unless you can clean it up, which of course can only happen through Christ, you're not going to get better. The first section is going to deal with things that have to do with unclean animals. So, as a general rule, the rules regarding clean and unclean animals are this. Clean animals are the ones you could sacrifice, and they're the ones you could eat. And so, of livestock, they had to have divided hooves, and they had to chew the cud. They had to do both of those things. That's exactly why pork is unclean, because pigs, though they have divided hooves, do not chew the cud. So that's why a pig is unclean, but a cow is clean. And then when it came to fish, they had to have fins and they had to have scales. So those are the things. They couldn't be, like sea serpents and things like that. If they were birds, they couldn't be any sort of bird that we would call a raptor, meaning it's a bird that preyed on meat. Vultures, definitely a no. Eagles would be a no. Hawks would be a no. Anything that ate other birds and fish and things like that. Those are all unclean birds. There was only one type of bug that you were really allowed to eat, and it was the grasshopper locust kind. Which is like you get to the New Testament, you have John the Baptist. What did John the Baptist eat? locusts and honey, right? So that's the general rules of clean and unclean animals, which allows us to skip a whole lot of verses very quickly, because that's given in some great detail. Anybody have any questions on that? Okay. And once again, these are both the rules for animals and bugs you can eat. And then they were also the rules for things regarding sacrifice. Now, like bugs, you don't sacrifice bugs, but you could eat them. Okay, the next set is going to be leprosy, and that covers, you're going to start about chapter 13. And the laws regarding leprosy will take you, about through chapter 15. Leprosy was a much broader term than the way we use it. And Leviticus 13 gives a good description of that. When a man has on the skin of his body a swelling, a scab, or a bright spot, and it becomes on the skin of his body like a leprous sore. Essentially, if he has some sort of skin condition that isn't going away, right? You can have a scab and you cut yourself and you end up with a scab afterwards. But it very quickly goes through that natural process and goes away. Well, what happens if you cut yourself and you get the scab and then it gets infected and it's not going away? That would be considered leprosy. It's a form of a skin disorder. Some forms of leprosy, some sort of skin issues, can be very contagious. It can be an infection that could easily spread to other people. Others, not so contagious. Some are terminal. Some are just something you have to live with. But it was a very broad spectrum, and it was one of the primary issues of that time period. It was the cancer of their day. And you think about infections alone, which many skin cancers are caused purely by infections. How do we get rid of... What's the modern answer if somebody has an infection? Antibiotics, right? And that didn't come around until you started hitting penicillin. So before that, if somebody got an infection, even go back to the Civil War, more people died from infections than they did from the actual wounds of the war. So this is, for us, this is such a non-issue now, but it was a very big issue back then. And so it was something people were terrified of. And it was something that could outbreak in a community and lay waste to a nation as a plague. And that's why you see some of these commands that God gives, and you go, oh, well, one, this is something that he told them to do, and he didn't always say this is why, but when we look back at it, we go, oh, God knew what he was doing. What did God have them do when somebody had leprosy and they weren't sure what kind of leprosy it was and what the condition was? You isolate them. And you'd isolate them for 7 days, and then you'd examine, and then you'd isolate for another 7 days. And there's a variety of conditions that the priest was looking for in the skin to decide whether the person was clean or unclean. And a lot of those basic ideas are what we call quarantining now. And the modern methods of quarantine find their basis in this. Modern medicine's beginnings of learning to quarantine patients came from reading the Old Testament. A lot of the basics of hygiene, of the fact that, hey, surgeons should wash their hands between patients, which seems like a no-brainer to us now, which didn't happen. Even in the beginning of, I think it was World War I, they were still not washing their hands between patients, except for one group of people. Jewish surgeons, they were washing their hands, and guess what happened with their patients? They had a much higher survival rate. Well, people started looking at that, and the Jewish ones were doing it just simply because of religious reasons. Turns out when you follow God, there's some secondary benefits that you weren't expecting. I have this one in here just to give comfort to men. If you're bald, you're clean. That's not the same as leprosy. I just thought it was funny that God wanted to give comfort to men. It's not a skin disease, it's just age. Leviticus 13, verse 45, this is what a leper was supposed to do. Once it had been decided, yes, you are a leper, yes, you are unclean, the leper on whom the sore is, his clothes shall be torn and his head bare, and he shall cover his mustache and cry, unclean, unclean. He shall be unclean, and all the days he has the sore, he shall be unclean. He is unclean, and he shall dwell alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. So once again, we got quarantining, and he's to cry out, unclean, unclean. So when he has to walk to the outside of the camp or be anywhere where he's around people, he has to cry at them from a distance and say, hey, don't get near me. I'm unclean. He has to cover his mustache and cover it, you know, cover his facial hair in the same way. What do you find if you have a food worker? What do men have to do in food services? Wear the beard nets, right? This is all medical protocol that God is building into their religious things. What's fascinating to me is when you look at how hard it was to live as a leper, it was beneficial to the society as a whole. But if you are diagnosed with leprosy, you had an awful, awful life. You have to dwell alone outside the camp. You can't literally are not allowed to have other people come near you. When you turn to the New Testament, almost every circumstance of Jesus healing a leper, you know what it says before he healed him? The first thing he did? He touched him. There's an act of compassion there. If you were a Jew properly practicing the Old Testament law and you were a leper, you never got touched. You had no other human contact. And Jesus did that. And so it's just a kind of a beautiful picture of his compassion that you see every time when you consider how little human contact they were allowed. It was good for everybody overall, but boy, what a hard life if you were somebody with a skin condition. Anybody have any comments or questions? Yeah.
On the 7 days.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I was quarantined for a week so that I couldn't go to school until the 7 days in case I got it.
Right.
So that's sort of does with the 7 days.
Yeah, it is. It's the same idea. We're going to watch and see if you outbreak with the measles too. And if you do, then you get quarantined like your little sister. And yeah, this quarantining process that we use today is... it goes back then. And like you said, the only difference now is we have vaccines. But, you know, really, we had, what county was it in Washington that had the measles outbreak? Thurston County? Guess what they were doing with all the schools and everything? They're quarantining. So they had to go back to the, kind of the old ways before we had stopped all this stuff. So, it works. I mean, that's the answer, is quarantine works. And it traces back to the Old Testament law. Yeah, God's idea. Big shocker. God knows what he's doing, huh? Okay, so that's leprosy. The next are laws regarding immoral relations. So this is, we're skipping, I hate saying skipping because we're not really skipping it. We've already talked about it. In chapters 16 and 17, it talks about atonement. And how when they were to make the sacrifices for atonement, for example, Leviticus 16:21, Aaron shall lay both of his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all of the iniquities of the sons of Israel and all their transgressions in regard to all their sins. We've talked about this idea of atoning, and they were to lay their hand on the animal. And in this case, you have a goat that you're going to then release off into the wilderness. Guess where we get the term scapegoat from? Right back here. So if somebody's a scapegoat, they're the one that you put all the problems on, you put all the blame on them, and you kick them out. It happens in politics all the time. Some big scandal, and they find one guy, they pin it on him, and he's probably not the only guy involved with it, but we're going to lay it on him and kick him out. That's the idea of a scapegoat today, the way we use it, but it comes back to Leviticus 16 and 17, where you have this goat that would carry the sins of away outside the camp. But we really looked at that idea of those sorts of sacrifices quite a bit already. So for all intents and purposes, we'll move on there. Unless somebody had a specific question in 16 and 17, if they've been doing some reading and or have questions. Okay. The only other thing worth mentioning in 16 and 17 I might add verse 3 of 17, any man from the house of Israel who slaughters an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp or slaughters it outside the camp and has not brought it to the doorway of the tent of meeting to present it as an offering to the Lord before the tabernacle of the Lord, blood guiltiness is to be reckoned to that man. He shed blood and that man should be cut off from among his people. The reason is so that the sons of Israel may bring their sacrifices, which they were sacrificing in the open field, that they may bring them into the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting to the priest and sacrifice them as sacrifices of peace offerings to the Lord. This, the temple was meant to be a place that consolidated all of the sacrifices. They were not supposed to be making sacrifices anywhere they wanted to anymore. If you wanted to make a sacrifice to God, you go to the temple or the tabernacle to do that. So that's another detail in chapter 17 worth mentioning, is that he didn't want them just making sacrifices all over the place. It was supposed to be at the tabernacle. Okay, from there we move to chapter 18. And in chapter 18, you have what are referred to as laws on immoral relations. And Leviticus 18, 26 through 28 will say that all of these different things, they were sins that the people in the land that they were about to conquer were involved in. And that was why God was spewing them out of the land. And so that they were not to commit these abominations. And that word, that's actually a really interesting word study, to take the word abomination, and every time it shows up, the things that God finds to be an abomination, you find that those are things that are consistent through Old and New Testament that God is displeased with. And he says, if you commit these abominations like the people who are in the land right now, guess what I'm going to do to you? I'll kick you out of land just like I kicked them out of land. So chapter 18 covers things like incest. And it goes into very specifics of exactly how far removed must you be from your connection to each other in the family tree before you're allowed to intermarry. And so he covers that in about 1 through 18 of chapter 18 there. He deals with homosexuality and the same-sex relations that were going on in the land. And he said, you are not allowed to do that. He covers bestiality, relations with an animal. He covers sister wives. In verse 18, he says, you shall not marry a woman in addition to her sister as a rival while she is alive to uncover her nakedness. It's an interesting thing that polygamy as practiced in America today, I know it's not legal, but they make TV shows about it, even though it's illegal. Oftentimes, the polygamy that you see practiced in America today, what is it? It's this sister wives thing going on. In fact, isn't that even the name of one of the shows they had at one point was Sister Wives? I mean, it's an abomination, that was specifically condemned. Even when polygamy was allowed, that was not allowed. And then the other thing that he'll cover is child sacrifice. That is in no way ever acceptable to him. And these were all things that were currently going on in the land. The child sacrifice, he specifically mentions the god Molech, who will show up throughout Israel's history. They're not going to get rid of the god Molech. He's going to stay around, and by the time you get to the kings, they're right back to child sacrifice. So all of these things are things that are pointed out as an abomination to God, and that they cannot happen if they expect to succeed as a nation. And when you look at America today, and you look at the sorts of things that are more and more acceptable to us as a society, kind of makes you wonder about our future. Then move to chapter 19. And chapter 19 will begin a variety of laws. So they're just not necessarily even deeply connected to each other, but just various laws Probably your Bible has the word sundry, which just means miscellaneous laws that they were to take into account. Chapter 19 starts with them reiterating no idolatry, but we've already covered that. We know that's wrong, so we can kind of move on from there. Did anybody have any comments or questions before we look at these various laws? Okay, so one, he's going to deal with some what we might call social welfare laws. When they get into land, always leave the corner of the fields for the needy. So as you are harvesting your crops, you would take in the corners, the edges, you would leave. And you would leave those edges so that any needy person could walk along any field and they could always get some food. One person that you can think of that certainly took advantage of that would be Ruth, right? And so that was God's welfare system were some of these different things. Verse 14 brings up another interesting thing is caring for those with what I broadly put as disabilities. You shall not curse a deaf man nor place a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall revere your God. I am the Lord. If somebody has a handicap or a disability, you have to take care of them. You can't mock them or make fun of them or do things to them because, you know, a blind person, you could put a stumbling block in front of him and he'll fall over and you know, some people might think that's funny. He says, no, that's not okay. It's part of reverence to God to care for people who are needy with the corners of the field, care for people with disabilities and not mocking their difficulties, but instead, of course, showing love. Verse 13 will deal with wages. Because we have to remember, this is a national law, too. So the wage schedule. In America, most companies will pay you every other week. That's pretty standard in America. In verse 13 of chapter 19, how often were you supposed to pay the wages of a hired man? Pay him the day at the end of the day. You worked one day, you get paid one day. And so there was no gap between when the man worked and when he got paid. So at the end of the day, and in the New Testament, Jesus will tell the parable of the men who went to work in the field for a denarius. And when do they get paid? End of the day, they line up and the landowner says, here's your denarius and here's yours and here's yours. So that's that goes all the way back to this law. There were trade laws down to verse 35. You shall do no wrong in judgment, in measurement of weight or capacity. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt. So there need to be standardizations of weighing things. You're going to be fair about that. No skimming off the top might be the way we would put that. It was a very common behavior, especially with coins, where what they would do is you'd shave around the edge of the coin. And if you take the shavings off of a gold coin, those add up, right, Oliver? I mean, just little shavings of gold. Not that Oliver's been shaving coins, but little shavings of gold add up. And eventually you find that you have quite a bit of gold. Well, that's what people would do. They would pay for something with a shaved coin so that they could get just a little bit extra. But that's cheating people. And so you weren't supposed to do those sorts of things. So there were trade laws. No partiality in judgment for even the poor. That comes up in verse 15. Verse 16 through 18 is where you get this very well-known command that comes up over and over again in the New Testament, which is love your neighbor as yourself, which Jesus says is the second greatest commandment. This is where it originally showed up. And it shows up in the context of 16 through 18, where he says, you shall not go about as a slanderer among your people. You're not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of it. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. If you took that out of Leviticus and you just showed those three verses, 16 through 18, to people, and then asked them, is that an Old Testament or a New Testament idea? How many people you think would probably end up saying they thought that was a New Testament statement? It sounds exactly like something Jesus would say, right? You shall not hate your countrymen in your heart. Don't slander people. You should not hate your fellow countrymen. You shall reprove him, but not incur sin because of him. So even when you're telling him he did something wrong, you can't hate him. This is stuff we would normally associate with the New Testament. It goes all the way back to the Old Testament. God's always been this way, and that's always been his goal for us, is that mentality. Verse 32 mentions rising up before the gray-headed and honor the aged. You shall revere your God. I am the Lord. So the attitude towards people who are older. So we go through these attitudes. Really, a lot of these laws are attitudinal ones. Your attitude towards the aged, your attitude towards your fellow countrymen, your attitude towards the needy, your attitude towards the disabled, how you care for them comes down to an issue, and it'll often say after it, you shall revere your God, I am the Lord. So how you treat people has a direct correlation to your reverence for God. And then verse 33 and 34 bring up the equal treatment for strangers. Anybody have any comments or questions? Okay, well then we will stop right there, and we will pick up next week.